Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Nick Velasquez, and Nick is the author of the book Learn, Improve, Master, and he's just all around an interesting guy. In this conversation, we talked about the culture and the differences of cultures and where he's lived and how that's played a role in his mindset. We talked about Usain Bolt and how his favorite video is of Usain Bolt. Nick is someone who is pursuing the highest version of himself, has written about it extensively, and for that reason, we obviously had an incredible conversation. So, if you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Share it with someone you think will enjoy it as well. And without further ado, this is Nick Velasquez.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Nick, thank you for taking the time today. I really appreciate you. You're a clear learner. You're a clear person who's involved in mastery. And because of that, I think we're going to have an amazing conversation. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Danny. Thanks a lot for having me. Excited to be here.
Absolutely. I'd love to start with the review of an 80-year-old man or woman, I'm not sure, who learned how to play the piano again. Yes. It's a beautiful story. Talk to me about how that came to be and how you felt receiving that review for your book, Learn, Improve, Master.
80-year-old woman, so she's a grandma. It's unfortunate because I can't really tell who it is. I couldn't just reply to it because you can't reply to these reviews. But she was basically saying that because of the book, she got inspired to take on the piano again. And she's in her 80s. And that she started also learning or picking back up chess. And she's like, this book gave me another kind of wind of starting these things and knowing that I can bring up my skills again, and also that she wanted to impart that knowledge to her grandchildren. It's like, maybe they won't listen to grandma, maybe they won't listen to their parents, but they'll listen to this book. And that to me is like one of the most significant things that I've read from all the reviews. And it made me think of all the times, all the hardship writing the book, and it made it worth it.
Why do you think it had that impact on her?
I think it was that she believed that she couldn't work on those skills anymore, that she couldn't get any better, that she was past the age, and that it was pretty much done. And the book talks about that even in older age, we still keep a lot of neuroplasticity. Our brain is able to change itself. So while she might not be playing the biggest stages, but she could still improve, and she could keep that skill very sharp. So I think that just renewed her sense of like, oh, there are all these other myths out there, like old dogs can't learn new tricks and things like that, that it have been repeated so often that we now assume they're true, but they're not. So there is more to it in learning and in age than we're led to believe. So we can learn anything at any age and we can improve. And I think that's what gave her that impulse, that motivation to pick it back up.
We have so many things in our culture and society that are little nudges that tell people that they can't change. Like, you hear that phrase again and again, you can't change, you can't change. Where do you think those phrases and that idea that people can't change, where do you think that comes from?
I don't know what it is. It's a bigger conversation, so we can go into all the shades of gray. So there are certain things about ourselves that we can't change. That's just who we are. Some things about our genes, let's say your height at a certain point, you can't do anything about. Different things like that. But there's also a big chunk that we can change and we can improve. So yes, maybe you don't have the genes to be the next Michael Phelps, but you could become a much better swimmer and you can become top swimmer in the world. So we have to remember that Michael Phelps wasn't the entire Olympic team, okay? The Olympic swimming team. There were many other great swimmers there. So you can become really good at it. Also, it's within everyone's power to become their very best. So at that point, you don't need luck, you don't need genes, you don't need to have been born somewhere or have a special coach. Like, all of us can be our very best. So regardless of genes. So we have one part that we really can't do much about, but there is a big chunk that we can do a lot about. And that part is even more important than the part that we can't do anything about. So in the studies from K. Anders Ericsson, who is an expert on expertise and expert performance, you can find some of these studies, I think, is the Cambridge Manual for Expertise, something like that. I can't remember the name exactly right now. But they figure that kind of natural traits and physical traits did not play that important role in most skills. It only came down to a very few skills, most of them in sports. And even in those fields, it didn't play that big of a role. So one that comes to mind all the time and that people like to bring up, it's basketball. Like, well, if you're not tall, then it's pretty much over. And, well, there have been some really awesome short players in the NBA. But the thing that's important to remember is that we made up this game. So it has some flaws, and it gave advantages to certain people with certain traits. So that's one thing. The other one is that basketball doesn't have divisions like we have for fighting. So if you watch the UFC and like boxing and things like that, it's so obvious the advantage of the physical traits that they created categories. So we talk about pound per pound best fighter. We don't talk about all time just the best fighter. Well, we used to think that way, but now it's like we recognize that there's more strength when you're heavier and bigger. So we created categories. In basketball, there are no categories. But if we created categories for basketball, you would have amazing players in any playing position, at any height. They would just belong to different categories. So the skills of basketball, which is shooting, dribbling, rebounding, all these other things, have nothing to do with height. So not because someone is already tall or very tall, it means that they're going to be automatically good at basketball. It doesn't happen that way. It gives you an advantage, but then the hard work that you have to put in to develop those skills, most people don't think about how much they have to work. It's not just height. Height gives you an advantage in playing and the way the game is designed and because it doesn't have categories. But other than that, like the skills themselves, they can't be developed by anyone. So there is a big chunk that we can work on. And it has nothing to do with you can't change it. I think part of the myth of why so many people believe like, oh, well, that's not for you. You don't have the talent. One of them is they're making excuses for themselves not to do the hard work. So sometimes they start a new skill and they spend 2 weeks and they suck and it's like, oh, this is not for me. Well, that's the learning process. You suck for a while until you suck less and less and you start becoming better. So then they make up an excuse saying, well, I just don't have it. I'm not big enough. I'm not tall enough. I'm not smart enough. It becomes an excuse to be able to quit. And it also becomes an excuse to bring other people down. It's like, don't try because that's not for you. That's not your thing because they don't want others to succeed. Because if those people succeed, then it kind of reflects badly on you. If I tell someone with my same physicality, like you can never be a swimming champion, and then they go on and become a swimming champion, now I feel horrible about myself. So it's not just me making an excuse to quit. It's also making an excuse for other people who are like me to quit as well, because then it will show up pretty bad on myself and my self-esteem if they do make it out of just sheer hard work and dedication, perseverance. So I think it's a combination of many factors. There's a lot of shades of gray into that conversation, but hopefully we cover most of the basics.
Okay, so let's say someone has it in their mind now that they can change and they can improve. What are the first steps to gain mastery?
Sure. So there are a couple of things, and most of it for mastery has to do with your mindset. So you go through the process of learning, and mastery is just kind of the end on the learning spectrum. I'm not the end, but like a very high degree of the learning spectrum. So we start as beginners, we go to intermediate, we go to advanced, and then we go into mastery. So the day-to-day things don't change, like deliberate practice, showing up to do the work, focusing on your technique, all these other things, they're kind of the same in the learning process. Now, mastery differs in the way we think about that practice as our commitment to doing the work every single day for years on end. So that's one, and that's one that few people take on. The other one is accepting the process. Like the process, sometimes learning something and learning it for a long time, sometimes it will be dull, frustrating, annoying, difficult, and we just have to embrace the process for what it is, not what we would like it to be. Learning is not always fun, but So you have to kind of embrace that process and trust it that it's going to take you to where you want to go. So that's another one. And for most people, they don't even start on the path. Like, let's forget about mastery for a second. They don't even start learning something because they have misconceptions of what it is to learn something. So as adults, we're already good at a few things. And we forgot what it's like to start from the beginning on something else. So you might be already good at your business. You might be already good at some skill that you practice. But then when you take on something new and you suck, you forgot what it's like. You forgot what the process feels like. You forgot how long it takes to get good. So you just assume you don't have it and it's not for you and you quit. So like that misconception of how quickly you think you should be improving and how easy it should be to pick up a new skill, that's something that prevents a lot of people from just starting. Not even talk about mastery, just getting started. Yeah, but then on the mastery side is really the commitment makes the biggest difference of all. It's like, are you committed to doing the work every day?
Do you think that before thinking about mastery, we should just think about enjoying something and liking it and seeing if it aligns with us? Because starting something and then trying to become a master is two different games to begin with.
Yes. So at the beginning, you have to be in the skill that you really feel it aligns with you. So I think the word you use is correct. But let's focus on the other part that you said, like enjoying. So many times the skills we choose are not enjoyable. And that's fine. But if it's fulfilling, then okay, we're on the right path. Let's say I took on writing and I do more and more writing now. And it's not enjoyable. It's tough. It feels like you're kind of putting together a puzzle that's fighting back. And most of the time you're just frustrated because you can't put those words and those themes together in the way that you want to. But in the end, when you finally do it, then you feel this satisfaction. So it's not supposed to be enjoyable all the time. It's not supposed to be happy all the time. So it's not necessarily joy when they talk about finding kind of your calling or your purpose or your passion. Many times it's just this process of discovery. And I'd like to think about it as relationships. Many times you see someone you're attracted to, that doesn't mean the relationship is going to go well or that's the person you should marry. So you go in and you're going to find a lot of problems, a lot of discussions, a lot of things where you don't align. But overall, your life is better because of it. So like, you know, you're kind of in the right path, but it's not supposed to be fun and enjoyable all the time.
But with writing specifically for you, don't you find enjoyment from the end result maybe? Or when you started doing it, did you ever find joy from it? I think sometimes as we go further along the process, we're like, wow, this is not enjoyable at all. And getting better at this is not enjoyable. But in that beginning stage, we're like, oh, this is fun and I like doing this and I'm drawn to do this and it's a calling. Do you find that to be the case as well?
That is the case. And that goes back to the analogy of relationships. So at the beginning, we have like an initial attraction. So maybe you pick up a new skill and it's like, oh, this is so much fun. But you're going to find hardships and you're going to find obstacles. So it has to be more than fun. It has to mean more to you than, oh, this is just fun to do. So with writing, and I like one of the quotes from Ernest Hemingway, who said, I don't enjoy writing. I enjoy having written. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true. It's kind of like when you finally build that puzzle. Think about it like video games. If they're too fun, you don't want to play them. The joy comes from like being challenged and having to level up to meet that challenge and then surpass it. Many of my favorite games, whenever I replay them, every time I'm playing, I'm like, I hate this part. And then I hate this part too. I hate this part. And then in the end, like, I hated the entire game. How come I enjoyed it? And it was because it was pushing you to become better. And it's that's what brings the most joy.
Yeah. And like a video game, if they don't acclimate you to the game where you're like, oh, this is easy. I like this. This is good. And then all of a sudden you get to a level and you're like, oh my God, I can't possibly do this. How am I going to figure this out? And from figuring it out, do you find and do you improve? And it's the same way with life. Life is really just one big video game.
Yes. So what I tell people is first you got to go into a skill, just kind of explore it. So don't commit too much until you find out what it's comprised of. So like go to an introductory class or like read about it, talk to people already in the skill. Because sometimes we have the wrong idea of what the skill is like. To give you an example, I took on flying lessons because I thought flying a plane was going to give me this sense of just freedom and joy and completely at peace. And it wasn't like that. Like flying a plane takes a lot of planning. You have to learn like your weather readings and all this stuff, and planning for weight. And then when you're up there, you're following all these guidelines. It didn't feel like what I thought it was going to feel. Same for people who take on writing. They think it's just you go into this cabin and just words are just flowing from you. And it's not like that. The essence of writing is in rewriting and editing. That's where you spend most of your time. So if you don't enjoy that part, most likely it's not for you. So at the beginning, we have to kind of explore the skill, see if it's really what we want to do, and see beyond the glamour of the end result. Another example is you see a musician on stage and you think, oh, wow, I wish I could be that person. I wish I could play on stage. Yeah, but you're not seeing all these hours of like grueling practice alone with scales on end. It's just doing the same scales over and over until you get them right. So that's the part. If you don't enjoy that, then that's kind of 80, 90% of it. So what you see on the stage is very minimal.
Yeah. Why do you think we romanticize the notion of being on the stage or winning the gold medal? Why do you think that's the first thing we think about in our head and not the hard work that takes to get to that point?
Because that's what sells. So it's the polished work. So even for the most popular games, so let's take NFL, which I know in the States is kind of like the top thing. If they started airing practices, most people wouldn't watch them. They want to watch the competition. They want to watch these elite players competing against each other. So you want to watch the game. You don't want to watch the practice. Because the practice is most of the time is boring. It's just you doing the same thing over and over, going through these drills and things like that. So it's not entertaining. It's not sellable. It's not many things. So we enjoy seeing that end result. And like, imagine if you got to see a writer just going through the process. No, you want to read the end result. And I'll cut myself there. Like, the process is for you and you alone. So in that sense, like, yes, we all consume just the finished product. And that's fine. But the issue comes when we think that these people are so special because we're only seeing the performance. So at that point, if we're interested in the skill, we have to look behind the curtains. Like, what does it take to get there? And like, maybe this looks amazing, but there is a process behind it. And the whole premise of my book is that it's like most of the time we see the end result. So we think we can't do what those people do. But there is a process that anyone can follow. So all of us can learn, improve, and master any skill. That's the whole premise.
That reminds me of your favorite video, which is Usain Bolt running around a track throwing up.
Yes.
Why did that hit you so hard?
Because I would never imagine it to be the case. You used to think as Usain Bolt, and the media likes to put these people like higher on a pedestal because it sells really well, like as these freaks, these geniuses, all these different things. And it's also easy on our self-esteem to think of them as different, as superheroes. Because then we think we don't have to do the work. But when you find that these people just kind of got to their level out of sheer perseverance, hard work. And yes, genes play a little bit of a role, but it's not the main, it's not the bulk. The bulk is in the hard work. Then you realize how little you push yourself. I mean, it makes you feel bad. So I think that's why. So when I was watching Usain Bolt and he's just running and then he stops, he throws up and then he keeps running. A part of me was saying, they probably added this for dramatic purposes. This can't be real. But then hearing more about him, at one point he's talking about having lost the championship on some race to a guy, Blake. And then he said, the amount of work that I put for the following month to prove all the haters wrong. He's like, I was throwing up every single day because I was pushing myself to the limit. And then you think like, wow, I'm just this wimp. Like I don't treat myself that way. And that's why he's over there and I'm over here. So I think that's why it hit me so badly is like it took him from God image to mortal image who's doing God-like things and that it was within everyone's capability. It's like, wow, I don't push myself not nearly as hard. Like not even 10%. And that so it hit me in the way of like, I'm not doing what I should be doing.
Yeah. And this hits me at something that I've been thinking about a lot is like the people on the pedestal that we put on a pedestal in the Western society so often have so many demons in their heart. And the success that they achieve is just a result of the demons. So it's like, would you even want to have Usain Bolt is different. It sounds like he's just trying to get revenge for that loss. But look at someone like David Goggins, who a lot of people put on a pedestal. It's like,
yes,
he dealt with some real racism, some real family issues when he was growing up. So mm-hmm. would you want to have that level of discipline and work ethic, or would you not? And so how do you think about that?
I think we all should be pushing ourselves a little bit more. We become very complacent and very comfortable. I'm just talking kind of general sense, because yes, we have people like David Goggins. I read his book recently, and it's amazing. And it hits you in the same way. Look, there's nothing really special. This guy did all of it out of just hard work and his mindset. So it is within our capability. So I think we should be pushing ourselves more in the sense of like, what are really our goals and what are we making excuses for? So if it's really within you to say, oh, I want to become a great at, I don't know, jiu-jitsu, but then you blame it on, well, I don't have the talent, I don't have the physical attributes, whatever it is, then it's important to see these people and be like, I'm just making excuses. But if your goal is to just sit on the couch and watch TV, then that's on you. That's fine. I mean, if that's what you want to do, that's okay. But for the rest of us who think, hey, I want to do all this, all the things, but I can't because this and that, and we're making excuses, it's important to remind ourselves, like reading about these people and saying, you know what? I should just shut up and do the work.
That's the answer most of the time, just shutting up and doing the work. And yeah. And one time that you did that was for a training, for a photo shoot where you had to cut down yes. for 5 months. Talk to me about that experience and what that was like.
Yeah, so a friend of, I was living in Japan at that point, and whenever I have more free time on my hands, I decide to take on this whatever project comes to mind that is kind of crazy and out there, it pushes me. So my friend wanted to do a fitness photo shoot, and I'm like, give me 4 months, 4 or 5 months. I don't remember what it was. And what came after was just pure madness. I started working out twice a week and just overhauling my diet. It's funny because as I'm thinking of talking about this after talking about David Goggins, like it's nothing. But to me, it seemed like a big effort. So overhauling my diet, all these things. And then the last month going into the photo shoot is really tough because you're cutting whatever little carbs are left. Your sleep gets destroyed. You're manipulating water and sodium intake. You feel horrible. You feel sick. You look malnourished because you are. And if anyone saw me that day, just out of camera, I would look malnourished and sick. But to the camera, you look amazing. So it's like these things that you have to do to achieve that goal. Now, the whole purpose was a fitness photo shoot. So people complain about promoting impossible standards. And my point is there are no impossible standards, only unreasonable efforts. What I think is really important is to be transparent about the process. It's like, hey, this is what it takes. It's not healthy. I don't look like this all year round. I was sick at that point. It was not good for me. My mood was all over the place. Like I'll get depressed and cry or just scream at people for no reason. Because your body doesn't know what to do. Like those levels of body fat are not normal. So you're just all over the place. And it's not okay. But then some people in the fitness world, like they portray themselves like they look like that all year round. And most of the time, they're just rehashing photos from previous photo shoots and stuff. So I think it's just important to show the process and say, like, look, this is what it took to get there. And then even then, like you need a good camera, a good photographer, good lighting, and all these other things that play a role. It's not like you see me walking on the street looking like that. That's not realistic.
Why we put that on a pedestal though, right? Like we put that shredded physique on a pedestal, but you're actually feeling like crap if you're actually doing that.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a problem there?
I think the problem is not being transparent about the process, like I said. Like it's okay, let's say, those models, those fitness models to come out and say, like, this is what it took for me to look like this. And then you get to decide, do I want to do that or not? So it's the same discussion. It's like looking behind the curtain, looking beyond the glamour of the end result. And I think we kind of put it on the pedestal because it sells. And so it sells magazines, it sells fitness products, it sells all the other things. Like whenever you watch, this is something that I used to think was really funny. Whenever those commercials came out of like 7-minute abs or like the abs machines, like get abs in 20 days or whatever. And the guy's super jacked. They're like, how did he get his pecs to be so big on this ab machine? Because what they're trying to convey is that he got those abs by using that machine. So how the hell he has these huge biceps and chest? That doesn't make any sense, right? Well, if it was only using the machine, then we would see this really skinny dude with amazing abs. But that's not what we see. And somehow it just doesn't compute. And for most people, it just crosses that reason barrier because they want to believe the lie that is like, I'm going to look like that if I use that abs machine. How are my legs going to get so big? I don't know. But that abs machine looks awesome. So it sells a lot. And it sells like on Instagram, like it gets people followers. Then you get to sell supplements, then you get to sell magazines, then you sell a bunch of stuff, and people are attracted to those what seems like impossible standards. And in a way, they don't want to think it's possible because what we talked about before, it makes you feel bad about yourself that it is possible and you're not doing it.
I'm super curious if this is something that's a result of Western culture or it's just human nature in general. And you've spent a lot of time in Japan, so I'm curious, is this the same, do they have the same wants for body image the same way that people in the West do? Is it different? What was your perspective on it?
It's very different. It was interesting because many people in Japan, so when I was going to the gym there, it was mostly older people. I'm talking 70s and up. I guess the younger people don't have that much time because they work a lot. But you don't see anyone like really big. Very, very few people. Like here you go to the gyms and there's always the jack dudes and stuff. And not in Japan because their ideal of beauty is slim and tall for men and also slim and short for women. So that idea of like the fit and muscular is not really part of their beauty standard. So I don't think they see it that well. For a foreigner, that's okay. But for Japanese, I didn't see them wanting to build muscle. In fact, it's really hard to find bodybuilding products in Japan. You pretty much have to buy them online from like US retailers. They're very expensive in Japan and you rarely find them. Where you find them maybe in some drugstores, but there's no like a GNC or like a supplement store. Not even in Tokyo, man. And we're talking about 40 million people, 38 million people for, what is it? The grand area of Tokyo. And you don't find supplement stores. Yeah, it's crazy. It's completely different. They have a different perspective of what beauty and health is.
That's wild. And what other differences did it strike you the first time you went like, oh my God, I can't believe people here are like this as opposed to that? I know you have one story with the postman delivering mail, but...
to me, the most impactful thing about Japan is their attention to detail and to quality. And this is an inner standard that they have, that everything should be done at your utmost capability. So whether people recognize it or not. So you would see in restaurants people cleaning under the tables, or I saw people vacuuming the sidewalk in front of their shops. Like, that's insane to us. That doesn't compute. Why are you doing that? Like, they want the entire experience of the customer to be perfect. And they're cleaning up things that no one would recognize they're clean, right? It's just for them. So in Japan, a lot of the honor that you get is from how well you do your job rather than what kind of job you have. So yes, they're very hierarchical anyways, but the honor on your job is like how well you do it. So something that struck me in Japan is that a cashier at a convenience store looks like a professional cashier. You would think that person went to college to become a professional cashier. Same for the taxi drivers. Like, this seems like a profession because they do it so well. And one time, this is one of my favorite stories. I was at a mall and it's Tokyo. It's packed everywhere. So like the washrooms, they need to clean them very often. I remember I was going to go to the washroom and then I see this team outside like of cleaners and they're stopping everyone like, sorry, like we're going to do the cleaning. And they put the ribbon. It's like, it's just going to be a couple minutes. And it looked like a SWAT team. The way they went into those washrooms, I was just kind of peeking there and I saw this guy cleaning this urinal. Like, my God, respect. respect. You're cleaning that thing. Like, it's the most important thing you'll ever do in your life. And you have respect for that. Here I find that a lot of times people are doing their jobs and there's this sense of entitlement that they shouldn't be doing that, that they should be doing something else. So they just do the bare minimum. Like, whatever, I'm just going to get through this because I should be doing something better. So they don't do it. They don't have that same standard of quality because they think they deserve more. Another story that I love about Japan is I was going to the Starbucks to write every morning, and the way they make your coffee is like they're delivering your baby. Okay, the attention to make it perfect. And I remember one time, so this woman is making my coffee and a drop just falls on the side and she just threw it out. I made another because it wasn't perfect. And the philosophy behind it is for that person, maybe that's the 1,000th cup that she had made that day. But it was maybe the only coffee I would get to drink that day. So it was important to me. And because it was important to me, it was important to her. Not at all the experience that I had when I came back to Montreal. Sometimes they'll give me my coffee and just spilling all over and like, hey, guys, here's another cup. Just put it under it. Like, come on. And every day would taste different. Whoever would make it would taste different. In Japan, it would taste exactly the same every time. Like, their attention to you, like, it needs to be perfect. That's what I try to apply that in my work. I try to apply that in my life, at least in the things that matter most. Because there is this thing of a famous line of the way you do something is the way you do everything. I kind of disagree in a sense with that. Like, some things don't really matter that much, and we just need to give more time to things that do matter. So I find that I would spend a lot of time on things that are important to me, and maybe not so much on like sending an email or stuff. I won't be putting that much attention to the quality of the email, but I will put even more attention on, let's say, my book. So every single detail I was attentive to. So to that degree is like somewhere in between the black and white. It's like, yes, you should put some quality into everything you do, but not necessarily like dread on every single detail on everything you do, because then it's going to drag from the other places where you should be putting even more. So yes, I took that from Japan. From the work that matters to me, I really make it my best, even if people don't get to notice some of the details. There are tons of details in my book that most people will never catch, but they're there and they satisfy me. It's like, this is great.
Yeah, like the Michelangelo quote, you went and talked to the professor after you saw this quote that you wanted to put in, and most people won't know that you talked to the professor, but you knew. Yeah.
It's funny because I bring out that quote sometimes. Most people wouldn't know about that, and I guess I've talked enough about it that maybe it's out there now. But the thing about the quote is like, that's the quote that kind of inspired the book in a way, and that's how I wanted to open it and everything. So it says, Michelangelo saying something along the lines of like, if people knew how hard I had to work to gain my mastery, it wouldn't seem so wonderful at all. So that to me encompassed like everything that I wanted to talk about learning and mastery. And the thing is, because it was such an important quote, I figured like I need to verify all these things and he actually said it. So I couldn't find any of the kind of proof that yes, he did say it. So I looked it up online. I did some research. I couldn't find it. So like, okay, I need to know more about Michelangelo. So I read Michelangelo's biography. It wasn't there. It didn't give me any clues. So then I took a lecture. And it was like 8-hour lecture, same professor who wrote the book. He's a professor in Cambridge. So he wrote the biography. He did the lecture. Like, I can't find this thing. So then I contacted the professor and he replied back to me with another document to read. And he was really nice. And he's like, I don't know. I can't place that quote. But so much of Michelangelo that his biographers made up. But now it kind of feel like it's part of the myth of Michelangelo and we can't separate it, the actual fact from the myth. So now Michelangelo is just kind of this intertwined reality and fiction. Because his biographers, like both of them, Vasari and the other one was Condivi, I believe. They both really admire him and they kind of embellish a lot of the details. So it's hard to put together a real piece of what it was. So I couldn't really find the quote. And then so I added this word in my book that says supposedly said. So before it said Michelangelo said. So then I added Michelangelo supposedly said. So it was, I don't know how many hours of work to add that word. which most one people, word. When you're reading, you kind of just ignore it. But to add that word, that was important to me. And it's there for that reason. So that's kind of like the sense of the Japanese, are like, this, it has to be done for me. That's my standard. Even if no one else notices, even if no one else cared.
It's your version of sweeping under the table or yes. The front of the shop, which is a beautiful exactly. thing. What advice would you give to someone who's going to Japan for the first time?
Oh, wow. Let me think. Well, they're going to have such an amazing time because Japan, to me, is the only place that I felt I was dropped in another world. Everywhere else that I've traveled, in Europe, in Asia, South America, North America, it feels the same human nature. But Japan is the only place that I felt I was dropped into a completely different world. One of the things is that the Japanese are going to be very polite, very nice. And that gives a lot of foreigners the feeling that they can do whatever they want. And I saw it and it was sad. And it's sad because to them, we're just foreigners. You can't really tell where they're from. You can't really tell, like, your identity gets dissipated among everyone else. So as much as I try to respect the rules and everything, when they see another foreigner destroying stuff, like, oh, foreigners, right? So they destroy it for everyone else. So you see foreigners kicking things, cutting in lines, doing things like that, because no Japanese is going to pick up a fight with you. No one's going to tell you anything. And because we come from societies where we're so, in a way, oppressed, we need to be kind of put down through laws so we obey and everyone behaves, that when we finally have that feeling of, oh my God, I can't do anything I want, then it all goes loose. Imagine, like, it's the same sense as when people get drunk. But imagine being sober and feeling like you can do whatever you want and no repercussion, unless you really messed up and now the police is involved. But I saw horrible things. Like, let's say a Japanese guy out of the clubs, Japanese guy would be talking to a Japanese girl, and then just foreigner just comes in between them to talk to the girl, because he knows no one's going to punch him. He would never do that in Europe or in North America, ever, because he knows he is in trouble. So you see that a lot. So my advice is respect that you're in a different place and respect their culture. Respect that they're very polite. Respect that you're being welcome. And their society works because everyone's doing what's best for everyone else and everyone's respecting everyone else's space. But when we're not used to that, we think we just have the right to do whatever we want. And I would cut myself in there because I did do some things when I first got to Japan that I had no idea that I was doing wrong. But to me, it felt like, well, it's okay, I guess, because no one's looking at me weird or anything. So like talking on the metro and talking loudly, they don't do that. And I was doing it and I didn't know it was wrong. You're supposed to keep quiet because you're respecting everyone else's silence. So those things, but some people know, and because they know no one's going to give them trouble, they just don't care. So you see people like spreading on the chairs and talking on their phone in the metro. And like, my God, how many wrong things are you doing there? First of all, this is Tokyo. It's packed all the time and you're taking three seats. And then you're speaking loudly and you're speaking on your phone. It's like a triple thing. And some people know it, but they still do it because they know nothing's going to happen.
How did you find out that you're doing the wrong thing?
When I went to live there. And then you kind of find out through their customs and talking to other people. And then they tell you, it's like, hey, you're not supposed to do this, not supposed to do that. They live by a lot of social conventions because they're not rules. They're not laws. It's just conventions is what everyone knows should be done. And because you don't know that and it doesn't seem like a big transgression, you don't bother learning them. But when you're there, you notice that for the Japanese, it's a big deal.
Do you think that those customs are going to get diluted in some way due to the internet and the global world? I assume that some of these customs came to be because Japan was an island. And I'm curious if you believe that those customs will disappear, maybe not disappear, but get diluted in some way.
They will. And they already are. Mm-hmm. You see more and more that young Japanese people don't want the traditional corporate life. So before, in Japan, if you went to work for a company, you work there for life. That was pretty much it. Unless you really messed up and they fired you, they were promised you work for life and you were pledging your life to them. And in Japan, work is an integral part of life. So we have a very different perspective. I don't know how far you want to go into this, but we have a very different perspective in the West. That is, we work so we can live, but we don't live to work. So we treat work as a means to an end. Like, this is what I have to do to earn my living. In Japan, your work is part of your life. It's important. It's significant. Most of the time, you're going to marry someone from the same company. And when you finish work, you go out to drink with your coworkers. It's your new life. It is part of your family. And to them, it's a fulfilling part of their life. So they don't have the same view of work. But that's changing now. So before, yes, you would go for a company. You work there for your entire life. And now people, it's the same ideas of want to get rich quick or want to do other things. So the gig economy is picking up in Japan. Younger Japanese people don't want to do the corporate lifestyle. So all these things are changing. And it's unavoidable. But a lot of the culture obviously remains. But yes, it is being diluted. The more they learn about different ways to do things in other places and more foreigners come in, it becomes more international. Even though Japan in many ways still, it is very closed because most Japanese in the world live in Japan. And most of the population of Japan is Japanese. So a lot of it still stays. And I hope it stays that way because it's such a beautiful culture. It's so special. It makes life, enjoyable.
What's the difference in how people treat work in Colombia? Because I know that's where you grew up. So you have Colombia, you've seen it in North America and Canada, and you've seen it in Japan really up close. What is it like in Colombia?
Colombia has the situation where we have a lot of unemployment. So it's hard to find a job. And companies know that. So they take advantage of it. So they say a lot like, oh, you have to put like the company t-shirt on. That's the way of saying like you have to kind of do more for the company, you know, like be part of it. But the company doesn't put the t-shirt of the person. it's not a reciprocal relationship. In Japan, it is. You give your life to the company, but that company, it's there for you. So in Colombia, I don't feel it's that way. And people work very long hours, but don't get remunerated in the same way because it's like, work is cheap and there's so many people looking for a job. So you can have all these titles. You could be a master's in all this other thing and PhD and you still get like a very low salary because there's just so much offer. You meet sometimes when you go on cabs in Colombian taxis, usually you talk to the cab taxi driver. That's just part of what it is. And you have a conversation. It's such a deep conversation. It's funny because in a way it's like an appointment with a psychologist because you get to talk about all your problems and all your worries and all these things to someone that is you're never going to see again. So you get to be open. So many times I sit in cabs and they'll be telling me stories about their wives. I'm telling stories about like finances and things going wrong in my life. And it feels like a friendship for many years, but it's with a stranger and you feel free to share because you're not going to see this person again. You're just unwinding. And you talk to these people and some of them, they could be doctors, PhDs, and they're driving cabs. And it's not well paid in Colombia, but because there are no jobs. So it's different in that sense. Then in Canada, it's part of it's like everyone should be remunerated in their way. So the laws are there also to protect the employees to the point that you feel many times you see the entitlement of like, I should be receiving all this stuff, doing nothing. So Canada is special because it's kind of half socialism, half capitalism. There's a lot of socialism in this society. So yes, people do get a lot of benefits. They get a lot of stuff. And sometimes they don't do the amount of work, but because the laws are there to protect them or to benefit them. So the government is very much for the worker. In Colombia, not so much. And then in Japan, you have that reciprocal, I'm giving you my life, but then you're giving me so much back too. That is a symbiotic relationship.
Which would you prefer? If you were to be raised in which culture and live and work in which one?
Well, if I were an employee, obviously the ones that give the most benefits to the employees. being a business owner, then I'll be on the ones that give the most benefit to the business owners. But you try to find some balance. So the thing is, you can make change within your own world. So I could be in Colombia, let's say, where it would be kind of more beneficial for a company, but then create a culture where it's, hey, I'm also giving a lot for you. But I'm not being forced by the government to do it. I'm just doing it in the way that makes the most sense and that is equal for our environment within our company, because all companies are different. The thing about a government is that they have to create a law that is like a blanket. And many times circumstances are very specific for different companies and different employees. So I would try to create an environment where like, hey, it's mutual benefit for both of us. And I'll help as much as I can, even beyond what the law demands from me, given the circumstances. And then maybe I'll ask from you something that is more beyond, but because given the circumstances. So you try to kind of build that in a way that is a negotiation of, we found the best solution for both of us. So I think in that sense, you would find a place that is the most flexible.
If you were president of Canada, let's say for one day or for one year, what rule would you have everyone follow?
I wouldn't know. It's one of those things where I don't have enough knowledge to give you an educated opinion. I just don't. And I think that's something that more people should do. Sometimes you just, I don't know enough about politics. I don't know enough about social norms that need to be implemented and then the repercussions. Sometimes you think that something will be good and then you implement and then you realize that the second degree consequence is even worse. So there's a lot to this and it should be, people in those positions should be really educated and very experienced. So I wouldn't know how to answer that. What I do want as a citizen, let's say, and this wouldn't be a law, but just a request from all fellow citizens, is to treat each other a little bit more nicely, be more respectful. Politeness goes a long way. So people in the West sometimes complain about the Japanese that they say, oh, well, that's kind of hypocrite that they would smile even if they're having a bad day inside. Like, that's not at all. It's just that it doesn't cost them anything to be polite to another human and then deal with their stuff on their own. To me, that's not hypocrite. To me, is they're giving you a decent human treatment that we all deserve and trying not to make your life even worse. And then their problems, they deal with them in their own way. So I prefer that way. Even if I'm having the worst day, I'll try to be polite to people instead of just lashing out. Like, that isn't fair. But here you see it. Sometimes you go into a store and person is in a bad mood and they won't hide it. Like, I'm coming into your store and you're acting like you're doing me a favor. what's going on? I'm here to purchase from you. Like, maybe a hello would be nice, you know? And you would find, so whoever travels to Japan and spends some time there, that politeness goes a long way into making life enjoyable.
What can we do on a day-to-day basis to make our society more polite?
It's just the simple pleasantries. Hello, thank you, good morning, how can I help you? It's just things like that. But in a way, so I guess that maybe also people call it hypocrite because sometimes here in the West, they don't feel like doing those things. They'll have to put up a front. The thing that I feel in Japan is that there's an honest kind of connection, an honest empathy of, I want to make your day better. And even though I'm having a horrible day, at least I get to improve yours. So they always look for other people and they consider other people. So I guess beyond the pleasantries is the underlying condition of having more empathy, of being like, hey, we're all interconnected. Even if I'm having a bad day, I don't have to spread that to other people. So let's just try to be conscious that everyone's fighting their own fight and not make it more difficult for them. So beyond the pleasantries is the underlying tone of, just think a little bit beyond yourself, dude.
Yeah, it seems like sometimes the West can take a bit of that, of me, and it's all about me, and take a step back and realizing that we're all interconnected and there's everyone is dealing with their own things, but to be kind is really the ultimate. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about a more darker topic, which is your father passing away suddenly. You know, you dealt with something where you were 30 minutes talking to your father, and 30 minutes later, he's passing away. And I think that is something a lot of people fear, and you lived it. So what advice would you give to someone who's dealing with a situation that they didn't control, they didn't know was going to happen, and suddenly the world is completely different in a negative way?
Yes. So many things, a lot to go over there. One of them, and just for people going through grief, this is not the greatest of news, but it doesn't go away. You just learn to live with it. So you learn to kind of put it in the back of your mind, but it doesn't go away. And it just becomes a break in your life that it forever changes the way you think, forever changes the way you behave. One of the things that I remember thinking the most about was just putting into perspective everything that I was working on. And I remember is like, why was I so worried about all these things and all these errands and all these things that I had to do for my company, the accounting and stuff, when I should have just spent more time traveling and being with them? And it's not, there's this usual regret that I should have spent more time with people. Well, we have to put it into perspective, because there has to be a balance. We can't just be the whole time with them, right? We also have our own lives and we need to live it. But I do think that I should have spent more time traveling to Colombia. And I always made excuses because I had too much work here in Canada. Like, I could have taken an extra week. It wasn't really, the world was not going to end if I took an extra week. Or just being present of the few times that you do spend with those loved ones. So before my dad passed away, when we were talking on the phone, he said to me, he's like, son, looks like you're working on something. Like, you're not paying attention to me. Like, oh yeah, I'm just going over this accounting thing. It's just a nightmare. I'm like, okay, then let's talk another day. And that was kind of the last thing we talked about. I'm like, really, man? Really? Did I need it to look at those numbers while I was talking to him? It's just being present. So it's not about spending all the time with them, because that's impossible. But the time that you do spend, that you're there, that you're really talking to them, that you're making it worth it, you know? So that's one of the things. So grief doesn't go away. You just kind of learn to live with it. The other one is the time that you do spend with your family and your loved ones, then make it count. Be there, be present. Putting things into perspective, a lot of the things that you might be worried about right now, they're not going to matter a week from now, or a month from now, a year from now. So it's hard to put, you know, what's important in front. But it's kind of a constant job of always reminding ourselves, like, hey, what's really the most important thing here? And for me, it's like, I should have spent more time. I should have just been more present in those conversations. The other stuff, the accounting thing, I don't even remember what it was. So just think about it that way. And what else? Like, life really, really changed. Life really changed. And I had to take more responsibility for my things, for my family, in my business. It was kind of a scary time because my dad was the head of the house and it was the one kind of keeping everything working. So the first sensation was, wow, there's no protection. There's no nothing. Like, this is all on me now. This is really all on me. But that's life. We have to go through that.
What do you learn from it being all on you?
One, that I could do it. Sometimes we think we can't, but then we're put into those positions and we have no choice. Another one is, it's really not fun to have tons of responsibility. So for the younger audience listening to this, just enjoy your university phase and your high school phase and all that stuff. Because, it's not that fun to have all that weight just dropped on your shoulders suddenly. And it takes a lot of your free time away. Those things, yeah.
I mean, I can imagine that it was it traumatizing? Is there like some level of trauma that is still there from that experience?
I don't know if trauma, but it's just that grief. It's always in the back of your mind. It's always a presence. And what's really funny, and this is a different subject, it's related, but let's say the day he died, immediately you go through like this panic and this horrible sensations, all these emotions, but nothing really had changed. So if you put it into this perspective of, let's say I didn't speak to him the following day. He was dead. I couldn't talk to him. But there were many days when I didn't talk to him for maybe 2-3 days. So the pain comes from the projections of your mind of thinking this person's never going to be there anymore. Because on the moment, nothing changed. You're just not talking to that person for a minute, for a day, for a week. How is that different from other times in the past? It's not. It's your concept of death and projecting it into the future of this person won't be there. That's what overwhelms you. Is if you just took in the present moment, nothing would have been different. But when you project to the future, that's where all the pain comes in. And it has to be traumatizing in a way. Maybe not in the sense that we would think about trauma of just like something that shook you so badly and now you kind of have recurring thoughts every now and then that are uncontrollable. No, but it is traumatizing in the sense that your life is different now. So in that sense, it is traumatizing. One of the things that I feel the most sad about is he spent his life mostly just working and running errands and doing all this stuff and not really enjoying. It was only towards the last few years that he was switching his mindset and trying to enjoy a little bit more. And then it happened. So when I look back on his life, it was always like, oh, there's this next thing that I have to do. And there's this other thing that I have to take care of. And like this all this problem. So for everyone listening, is the point of like, you have to start enjoying right now. Because there won't be a time later in the future when you say, oh, now I'm going to do it. You have to balance it. I used to think, if I work really hard, if I make all the sacrifices, then I'll get to enjoy later. If you've never taken the time to enjoy, it's kind of a skill. Then you won't do it later. If you haven't done it in the past, what makes you think that something's going to change and suddenly you're going to start enjoying life? If you don't make it now a habit, if you don't force it now, it's not going to happen later. And many times our projects take longer than we hope they would take. So for me, I thought I was going to make it big and make all this money like early 20s because I thought I was such a big shot. I was running the right business and all this stuff. And no, it didn't happen. So when I look back, let's say at my teens and very early 20s, my friends would call me up on a Friday night and be, Nick, let's go out. I'd be like, no. Like, what do you mean no? Like, I'm studying because I have work to do and all this stuff. Like, but it's Friday night. Like, doesn't matter. I don't want to work all my life. In a way, yes, it's important that we do the grind and then we think of our future. But a lot of the things that were age appropriate that I should have been doing at that time, I didn't do. And now you look back, it's like, was it really that important that I spent those 3-4 hours reading that other book on that Friday night instead of maybe being with my friends that are no longer around me because I live in a different country? So it's putting things into perspective and making it a habit of enjoying a little bit more, especially taking care of relationships. It's really all about people in the end. One of the quotes that I keep in my mind the most from Christopher Hitchens says, the bad thing about growing old is that you can't make new old friends. Old friends only happen through time. If you're not putting that time into strengthening those relationships right now, you won't find them later. And it's not something you can buy with money. So we have now this obsession of the grind, and it's become, I don't know what's the right word, but it becomes an obsession and a fantasy. And that's not healthy either. And in the end, let's do this very short exercise. This takes 2 seconds, but think about the nicest moments in your life. Think about your favorite memories in life. I guarantee you they have people in them. So that should tell you a lot.
It's so fascinating because on one hand, we talked about Usain Bolt throwing up from training. And on another hand, we're talking about enjoy the moment, enjoy what is. And I don't think they have to contradict each other. I think it can work really hard and also appreciate the moments and be present. But what have you found to be the best ways to do that?
To be present?
To balance.
The, yes.
The work and discipline needed to achieve something in this world, and also the enjoyment of the moments with friends and the enjoyment of just the little moments and being present. How do you balance those two?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we think, let's say on the Usain Bolt example, we think that he just worked out and trained. Let's imagine that we're waking hours of 16 hours. And we'd imagine he would be working out the 16 hours. No. Olympians and top-level musicians, they might train for about 3 hours a day. And if they do two different workouts, it might be split into 2 hours and 2 hours. Maximum 6 hours. Like, let's say it's two times a day, 3 hours in the morning, 3 hours in the afternoon, which I don't think they do. Because for most of what I read, most people, like, let's say writers, professional writers, the most they can work is about 3 hours a day. Same for musicians, like concentrated, really being there and making practice worth it is about 3 hours a day. What are you doing with all the other hours? So we tend to think like it's either this or that. It's either we're putting everything and we're training, we're going to become champions, and then we have to sacrifice family and all this. No. It just needs you to be organized. So put those 3 hours, you know where they come. The thing is that most of the time we spend thinking, I'm not doing the things I should be doing. If you kept a time journal, which I encourage everyone to do for about a week or two, you'll realize how much time you waste. It's ridiculous.
So break down the time journal.
Yes.
How do you do that?
You're writing down everything you're doing and how long you're doing it for. And I've noticed, this is going to sound ridiculous, but I noticed after 2 weeks of doing it that I was spending hours and hours walking around my house thinking about what to do next. Yep. Or worrying about the things I should be doing that I was not doing.
So what'd you do about it?
Just do it. If you have something to do, just sit down and do it. But we spend so much time thinking, I don't want to do it. I have to do it, but I don't want to do it. Okay, I'm going to do it after. Oh, first I got to do this other thing. Oh, but wait, let me grab something from the fridge. Oh, that's right. The mail just came in and then you walk again. So the amount that we spend in transitioning from one thing to the next, I'm encouraging you to do it. Do it for a week and then you'll find out how much time you waste.
Have you heard of the program 75 Hard from Andy Frisella? It's a 75-day program where for 75 days straight, you have to do two workouts a day. One of them has to be outside, drink a gallon of water, take a progress picture, read 10 pages of a book, and follow a diet. And you can't have alcohol or cheat meals. But what I found from doing it was that the voice in my head that told me, oh, I don't want to work out today. Okay, just give yourself off today. That was gone because you didn't have a choice and you just had to do it and you just had to go to the next workout. And that voice in your head that would spend arguing stopped. It stopped that voice because you didn't have a choice. And I think that's one way to remove the voice or at least become aware of it. Like I started to become aware of it when I did the program. So something to consider maybe.
That's awesome. And that's one of the things that I do now for working out. So I work out every single day unless I'm very sick. And I've been working out like that for a long, long time. And when I tell people about it, they say, well, that's so much discipline. And my point is, no, it's the opposite. It's because I'm not disciplined that I have to do it every day. Because I'm not disciplined enough to do it 3 days out of the week and then the other days don't do it. Because then I make up excuses and I say, I'm going to move the day. So yeah, the following day, I'm going to take today off. When you do it every day, there's really no excuse. You just have to do it. You know you have to do it. It's another day you have to do it. So I encourage everyone to just try. If you're having trouble sticking to a habit, try doing it every day, maybe for a shorter time frame or shorter intensity. It doesn't take that much. It actually takes much less discipline to do it every day than to do it a couple times a week.
Because you have a habit. So what is your exercise routine?
It's the first thing I do in the morning because it's the toughest for me mentally because I try to make up excuses. So I try to get it like out of the way, not let myself think too much about it. So it's like I wake up, I may take like some supplements and stuff, and then I go train. And sometimes I'm already training. You're like, what am I doing? I don't want to train today, but like, it's too late. I'm already there. So that's the first thing. And I find that when I train my body in the morning, then I have all these other benefits where I'm clear-headed. I feel great. it allows me to take on other challenges. When I was writing the book, that was the second thing that came. So first was training my body, then was doing the creative part, which was very draining. So for about 3 hours, I would write. So then working out for about an hour, maybe 45 minutes, and the writing. And after the writing, like I already won the day. I trained and I wrote, I won the day. And the rest was be like taking care of my business. And the last part to unwind was reading, which is very important in my life too. I read every day. Same thing. If I find that I start doing it every other day, then I end up weeks without reading. But if I'm reading every single day, that's the way for me to stay on track. So that's kind of how I go about it. Yeah.
I love it. And speaking on the reading piece, you know, I was just listening to you talk on this podcast with this guy named On Abdi, I believe. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, I think so. I'm not sure about the last name, but his name is.
Okay. So I was listening to this podcast and he talked about how guy who was reading books, I guess self-improvement books or mm-hmm. just books in general for, you know, 30 years and he was in his 50s. And he said, you know, I've been reading these for like 30 years and nothing's happened. And that scared the hell out of me. I'd never heard of anybody in their 50s get to that point. So does that scare you at all? Did that have that reaction when you heard that story or what do you think about that?
To a lesser extent, I think it happened to me too. Not like the 30 years, but like many books. And the reason is that you're afraid to do what it takes to make the actual change. So you think if you just read another book, if you just got that other piece of knowledge, then everything will be okay. And it's because you're avoiding doing the work. Change is part knowing what you need to change, knowing what you need to do, and the other part is actually doing it. So I find that you make the excuses of, I just need to read this other book. You're thinking that you're going to find a magical piece of information that is going to exempt you from doing the work. And that's why you keep reading. But if I stop reading right now, I have enough things to work on for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And even two lives or three lives. I take a book like The Laws of Human Nature by Robert Greene. I could spend the rest of my life just studying that book and applying those lessons. Because applying things is going to take much longer than learning them. And that's part of the high that people get in reading books. Reading a book, it doesn't take long. You can read it in 2 days, 3 days. It takes a couple of hours. You feel good. You feel like you accomplished something. It goes on the pile. You get to brag about how many books you read. It goes easy. But making the actual change, it takes a long time. So it's the same for learning skills. The theory side of it, you're learning pretty quickly. That's why it's enjoyable to go to seminars. You feel like you're gaining so much. But developing the actual skill is years. So for that gentleman, it's like you've been reading the stuff, but you're not applying it. And that's why. And you keep trying to find a magic pill. And there's no magic pill. You're going to have to put in the work at one point. So like, for example, someone that has social anxiety, like I was very shy growing up. And you just want to find that magic piece of information that is going to get rid of your shyness. No, it's just you have to put yourself out there and just progressively getting better and talking to people and facing the discomfort. And you don't want to face the discomfort. That's why you keep reading the books. That's why you keep trying to find a magic formula.
Dude, it shocks me to hear that you had social anxiety.
Man, I was so shy when I first moved to Canada. I couldn't get pizza delivered in my place because I was too shy to talk to someone on the phone.
No way.
Yeah.
How'd you get over that?
What were we talking about? So it's like part knowledge and then part applying it. And part of it, like I took this path of what is the, for me, like what would be the scariest thing in this position where I need to develop the most proficiency so it goes away all the shyness and all the social anxiety. And it was obviously like attracting the opposite sex. So that led me to this path of seduction and like learning to interact with women, like going to a bar and talking to a girl, like that's scary. I don't think girls realize how difficult it is for guys to approach. Some of them, they just don't care and they just do it. But for someone that grew up shy, that is like the scariest thing you can do because you're just approaching someone, putting yourself in that position of being rejected in front of all her friends and in front of all your friends. So that's one of the harshest, also it's an environment which they're being approached all the time. So, and they can be mean or because maybe everyone approached before and they were assholes. So now they have to put up this front to protect themselves. So it's like a very harsh environment. And when you kind of learn to do it in that environment, like everything else becomes a little bit easier. So that was my path. And that's kind of how I got over it.
What was that like to be like a shy person, like that couldn't interact and get nervous without feeling some sense of fear?
The fear never goes away. And that's one of the secrets. It never goes away. But it's the same for any other profession. So every professional fighter will tell you they're shaking before they go to fight.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to Georges St-Pierre the other day, and he was like, I feel this thing. But also to them, it translates into excitement, but it's the same anxiety. So it's kind of what spin you give it in your mind. But they're still nervous, very nervous. It doesn't matter how good they are. They think that for some reason, all their skills just disappeared. They're going to get punched in the face in 2 seconds and just knocked out. Even though the odds of that happening are very minimal. But they're still, same for musicians, they throw up before concerts. It happens, but they learn to behave in a way that it doesn't look like they're going through that anxiety. But we're all anxious in many ways. We just learn to be proficient. So the fear never goes away. And some people, they're looking for the magic formula of like, how do I make this go away? You don't want it to go away either, because it means it's important. One thing that I think I've never talked about in podcasts before, my uncle, he's a very famous comedian back home, probably one of the most famous ones. And I was talking to him, and I asked him, like, do you feel nervous before you go on stage? He's been doing it for 50 years, like an older gentleman now. It's like, I'm afraid every time. And the day that I don't, I'll quit, because I'll know it doesn't mean anything to me anymore.
Wow.
So that's another way to look at it. Like, you're nervous because it's important to you. And all these emotions that we label as negative, they have a function. The problem is when they go like overreactive and we kind of create a narrative behind them. But fear is an important emotion. Without it, we wouldn't be here. We'd have jumped out of cliffs and all die, or try to pet the tiger who's nearby. Like, no, man. It was important that we had fear, that we had anxiety protected us. It made us behave in certain ways. So there is an evolutionary advantage to having these things, is when they go amok that they create problems. But for now, whenever you feel anxious about some work, let's say if you wrote a book and put it out there and you're afraid that it's not going to do well, it's because it matters to you. So if you didn't feel anything, maybe you're not in the right place.
It's a very interesting insight. What else have you learned from your uncle, who's a comedian or one of the most famous comedians? What have you taken from, other than the fear?
He plays characters, and then people assume that he's those characters. So he's a comedian and people think he's just funny. He's super dark. And he's the biggest intellectual that I know. His library is thousands of books, and he reads in all the time, and he mostly reads philosophy. And he's this, when we are at family reunions, he's just a very serious guy. He's never joking around or anything like that. His profession is very different from who he is. A very dark character. And people don't believe me when I tell them that. So it's one of those things. You can be anything. Like, you can create a character for what you need. So for that profession, he found that. One of the things, my favorite philosopher is Nietzsche. And I was reading in this book that many people, he promotes this idea of like facing discomfort and facing hardships, to live a better life and to find meaning and purpose. And some of the critics have said like, well, yeah, he talks about all this, but he didn't live his philosophy. Look at what he did. He was just in Salisbury, just writing, kind of hidden in this room. No, read his writing. That's courageous.
Mm-hmm.
He lived his courage through his profession, through what he did. So for that, he built his character. He lived his philosophy, but through his work. So it's different. That I thought is like, wow, amazing. So it's like, whatever you need to do, maybe you're not the most outspoken person, but maybe you find that your medium is writing, and you can be outspoken in your writing. That has as much value. So it's just something to think about.
That goes back to how we started the conversation, which points to you can change. You can be someone else. You can evolve into something in a different arena. And seeing those examples of your uncle and Nietzsche points to the idea that people can evolve and change and be what they need to be for any given moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a beautiful thing.
what I find most beautiful on the philosophy of Nietzsche is he doesn't talk about it as change. He says becoming who you are. So we know we have these aspects of ourselves. They're there. We behave in a certain way because we just kind of picked up things unconsciously along our growth. And then we assume that's our natural way of being and that everything else would not be us. But all these things, we just learn them like anything else. It's just that it feels natural to us because we absorb them unconsciously. But many of these other traits are also there that we can nurture and kind of bring out more to light. So one example here is, so I describe myself as shy, but that's not the whole story. I was shy to people I didn't know, but if you saw me with my friends, I'll be the most outgoing, probably the one leading conversations, the one holding court and bringing everyone together and being like the most daredevil of all of them. But when it came to meeting people, I was shy. So maybe some of those other friends that didn't seem as outgoing in the group were a little bit more friendly towards strangers and didn't feel as anxious. So it depends on the context. Sometimes we're this person in a context and we're another one in another context because we have shades in our personality and we access them at different points. So the goal is not change, it's flexibility. It's how do I bring this guy who is social with his friends to be social with strangers? The tools, you already have them. You know what it's like. You know what you need to do. It's just being able to transfer them from one context to another. And in my book, I talk about that step as bridging. But we can think of it as transfer. And that's when you're practicing something in a safe environment, but how do you take it to performance? So someone learning jiu-jitsu and is practicing the same armbar over and over, yeah, that's one thing. But when you have to do it in a fight, it's a completely different thing. How do you bridge that gap? So for me, it's like I'm very social with my friends. I'm not social with strangers. How do you bridge that gap? In jiu-jitsu, it would be you start sparring. You're with a training partner that's now fighting back a little bit. So now it resembles some kind of like a real fight. With being social, maybe it's like, hey, be with your friends and invite people that you don't know to that circle. So it's like you're bridging slowly when it's less people that you know and more strangers in that circle until the point that you feel comfortable just approaching a group of strangers and being social with them. So they're a way of bridging because the skills, you already have them. It's a matter of transposing them to an environment where you don't have access to them.
Life really is just one big video game, right? That's crazy. But yeah. Nick, this has been a tremendous, tremendous amount of fun. I'm so grateful for this. We covered so many things and I'm so grateful for that.
That was wide ranging for sure.
Where can people find more from you and check out your book?
The book is available everywhere. So it's called Learn Improve Master. The easiest place to find me would be through my blog. It's unlimitedmastery.com. And there I have all the handles for social media and stuff. So unlimitedmastery.com, that's probably the easiest. You'll find links to the books too there. So that's the easiest place.
Awesome. And they'll be down below. Thank you for taking the time. I really appreciate you. And
Danny, thanks so much, man.
This was great.
Like another time. I think we have a lot to talk about.
Hope you enjoyed that episode with Nick. If you have any thoughts or feedback about this episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. And if you liked it, please share it with someone you think will enjoy it as well. Just wanted to take a moment, as always, just to give you my gratitude for listening until this point in the episode. It means the world to me. I'm extremely grateful for anyone who spends 1 second, let alone an hour and 19 minutes on listening to questions I ask. So just a thank you from me to you. Hope you're well and have a wonderful rest of your day or night. Peace.